they sort of disappeared for 10, 15 years, and there weren't that many of them out there. But in the last 3-4 years, they're making a bit of a comeback, and people are catching them a little more frequently.
Hey there, thanks for joining me for episode 22 of the Maritime Outdoorsman podcast. And today I'm going to connect with Trevor Avery, a marine biologist and professor at Acadia University. So let's get with Trevor and have a chat about the Minas Basin, the Bay of Fundy, and some perhaps some lesser known species and the impact that they have and what we as anglers can have on them. Hey, I just wanted to take a minute now to thank my friends at Flowers River Lodge, Hawk River Outfitters, and Crooks Lake Lodge for sponsoring today's episode. If you haven't been to Labrador to any of these three lodges, fly fishing for trophy Atlantic salmon or brook trout, I would highly encourage you to take a look. Just go to maritimeoutdoorsman.com/Labrador and find out everything you need to know there. So maybe just take a second and tell everybody a little bit about who you are.
I'm Trevor Avery. I'm a professor, adjunct professor at Acadia University, and an instructor here as well. I teach in the biology department, and I research animal systems, movement, population, demographics, etc. in a lot of different animals, but mostly in marine organisms.
Cool. Yeah, that's what... That's what's brought us together today through a friend of a friend. And so I understand, you know a little bit about some of the fish species that we have around. And now, is your focus the Bay of Fundy, or is it all around the province?
Mostly up in Minas Basin.
Right.
Though we venture out into the Bay of Fundy. We've got a skate project that works on both sides of Minas Passage there where Cape Split is.
Okay.
And but I've also looked or had my students look at rivers around most of Nova Scotia. We've looked at lakes in Nova Scotia. So we've done some projects in other places.
Nice.
Eels along the eastern shore.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Stuff okay. like that.
Awesome. So I, you know, previous to this discussion, we talked and we decided that, or I think, you know, you suggested, and I think it's a good topic of conversation. So I know, myself, you know, growing up in Nova Scotia, fishing around the shorelines, or out in boats, I know many of us, catch these different species that we may consider quote unquote trash fish or, you know, a nuisance fish. And so we're going to talk about a few of those today, and maybe you can give us some insight on how that may not actually be the case, and you know what those species places are in the you know, in our marine environment. So one that you just talked about is skates. So I guess maybe we should start there.
Sure, no problem. So we have a number of skate species in and around Nova Scotia. The two most common ones and the ones that are most often caught by, say, recreational anglers along the shore, and a lot of the times these are striped bass anglers who catch these because they're kind of surf fishing out there in the out in the surf when the tide's coming in and going out. We have winter skate and little skate.
Okay.
And the two species are what we call sympatric species, and they're also cryptic. So they live in the same place, and they look very similar to each other. And you really can't tell them apart until they get bigger than about 40 centimeters in total length.
Okay.
And even then, it's pretty tough to tell them apart.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have quite a bit of, what would you say, plasticity in their body shape.
Okay.
So those two species are out there. They're pretty widespread. Pretty much everywhere that we look for them, we find them.
Mm-hmm.
They're brought up a lot of the times in the greater Bay of Fundy or that larger Bay of Fundy area by trawlers that are trawling for other species, flatfish, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll bring them up as bycatch and then pitch them back overboard again. And we get that also in some of the smaller scale trawlers that are in the mine space, and they get caught in weirs, places like that. So we've basically gone out and tagged a whole bunch of these. Like, I think we have, what, 3,000 tags in now.
Wow.
So we're sort of getting an idea of where they move, what their population size is, and our estimate is somewhere probably 30 to 50,000 of these skates out in Minas Basin, just in that area from Cape split up. So odds are you're probably going to catch one time if you got bait on the bottom.
There
are species that likes the bottom.
That
doesn't mean they won't swim up into the water column. I mean, they do swim over weirs, for example.
Right.
But they're basically bottom scavengers. They feed on anything they can find there. They'll root out clams and worms and green crabs. They take green crabs.
We've done some
content analysis, so they're a good one to clean up some of the smaller green crabs that are out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Bad invasive species that we have
right
here.
Exactly.
And you know that their job is basically to anchor down that they're sort of the top level predator in the bottom part of the ocean. So they roam the bottom and they clean up anything there that might fallen down from the surface, for example, or deadfalls or anything like that. So they'll feed on anything that falls down. And that's why you catch them as a when you put a big hook out there with some bait on it and it falls to the bottom and they come along and they're trying to clean that up. So they're pretty opportunistic, but their jaws are designed to basically crush clams and crush shellfish and things like that. So that's what they're primarily going after, but they'll basically pick up other things as a scavenger.
Interesting. Are the numbers remaining like good, or over the years have they experienced declines and good years, bad years, or is it pretty steady?
Well, that's part of why we're doing some of this research, is we just don't know.
Right.
The question was a very simple one from a commercial fisher was, are these the same skates I'm seeing in my weir all the time, or are they different ones?
Right.
And we said, well, that's a pretty easy experiment. We just come down and tag a bunch of them, and we found out that there's a lot of them, but they are pretty patchy.
Okay.
If we tag in one area, we seem to get the same tags back in that area, and it takes 1 or 2 years to pick up tags across the other side of the bay. So they don't seem to move too far. They seem to be more, their movement patterns seem to be more of, they go from the deeper parts of the bay, move up into the intertidal zones when the water's covering those areas, and then they move back into the deeper parts of the bay, rather than sort of moving around the bay like other species will do, like striped bass and some of the other shad and some of the other species will move around the bay a little bit more. So their population sizes, we don't know enough. We don't have enough information for enough years in order to tell us enough about whether it's going up or down.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know historically there was a pretty large fishery for these guys back maybe 25 years ago, and that fishery now is down to a very small fishery. And in fact, I don't think there's anybody actually commercially doing it right now. So from a federal perspective, a Department of Fisheries and Oceans perspective, these two species of skate are pretty much not fished commercially. And most of that would have happened out on the Scotian shelf anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Nova Scotia.
Yeah. So that was a commercial fishery. There was a demand for that fish in the food market?
Yeah. Well, I think there still is. Mm-hmm. There are people that eat them if they catch them recreationally.
Mm-hmm.
You can cut the wings off. They basically have these two large, they're a flattened body, and they basically have these two large wings that they undulate to swim.
Mm-hmm.
And those wings are quite meaty. They've got some cartilage in there. They have they don't have bone. They have cartilage. They're like basically like shark.
Okay.
If you cut that off, and there's lots of meat in there. In fact, one of the things that that the food industry does with skates is they punch out their wings and make fake scallops.
Okay.
Or
yes.
Scallops, as they call them around here.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you can look for. You can tell the difference, though, because a scallop has the meat goes up and down,
yes,
whereas a skate wing will go laterally, so side to side. So the layers of the meat. So.
Right.
Yeah, so they are tasty to eat. They are eaten in a lot of places in the world. The Asian market is quite large on skate, and it is something that... that could be a viable product around here in a small scale.
Okay. So when people are angling, let's say striped bass, because that's the most common in the Minas Basin area, and they catch these, I mean, I've heard over the years, I mean, many people, you know, that do, they consider them basically a trash fish. I'm sure there's a lot of abuse goes on with the fishery, as there is with the striped bass fishery, unfortunately, too. But... So is there a proper way to handle skate to get them off a hook, or is that maybe one of the things that's resulting in this sort of stereotype that the fish has? Are they dangerous fish to handle in any way, or is there really no threat and they're quite easy to get off a hook and put back?
Yeah, they often are mistaken with things like stingray.
Mm-hmm.
And so the difference here is skates don't have the stinger, whereas rays have the stinger, and we don't have any stingrays that we encounter up in this area. We do have some stingrays, but they're deeper ocean species.
Right.
So skates are they do have some spines on them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you grab them with your bare hand, depending on how old it is, you might get a few of these sort of, you know, maybe 3-4 millimeter long spines. But they're really more of they're not going to pierce your skin or anything. They're more of just an irritant.
Okay.
But to pick them up by the sort of bulky part of the tail near the body or grab them by the snout, they're quite easy to pick up. Even a 70 or 80 centimeter one, you can pick up that way without too much problem. They don't have teeth, or they do have teeth, but they're very tiny in their jaws. But their jaws are pretty powerful. So if you get your finger stuck in their mouth, which is on the bottom, then that's going to, if they clamp down on you, that's going to hurt a little bit, like you're hitting your thumb with a hammer.
Right.
But basically they're, you can pick them up, by the snout and the tail, just like you would any other, fish. They might be a little bit, active, but they're not all that aggressive. They'll usually just lay there.
Okay.
They're pretty tough. But they'll also, when they're eating something, they'll probably be taking hooks in pretty deep. So that's a problem there. It might be the best thing to cut the line if it just happens to be a dollar or two
hook
on there. But they don't have a very big mouth, so they're not going to be able to take anything very large.
Okay.
I think the typical thing to do is to try to get rid of them, which is not... in the best interest of the ecosystem, of course.
No.
But I think the bycatch is pretty small in recreational fishery on these guys. We talked to a lot of recreational anglers for striped bass, and very few of them have caught skates. More of them caught eels than skates.
Right.
And that's pretty interesting, because there's not a lot of eels out there, whereas there are quite a few skates. So.
Yeah, the few times I remember back in the 90s, the few times that I did try bait fishing for striped bass, most of what I've done is casting lures off the shore or flies, but I do recall either catching the odd eel, or you could just see a whole board right through, like we were using whole mackerel or half a piece of mackerel, and you could just tell that an eel had drilled a hole right through it. But they're basically just a nuisance along with these other species that we're going to talk about, because they're psyching you out when your bait's out on the bottom. You think you're getting a bite with the target species you're after, and obviously it's not. You mentioned the eel numbers. Are they low for the time being, or is that something we don't really know if the numbers are fluctuating or not?
Overall, eels are basically suffering a bit. If you go into some rivers, there's not as many as there used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some rivers where eels are quite plentiful. Some,
okay.
They're basically a watershed level organism, so
right.
They'll come up into a river system and then they'll occupy the estuarine area, they'll occupy the river area, they'll occupy the upper lakes in that same area.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a little bit different species from, say, our striped bass or our anadromous species, our salmon and striped bass. They
mm-hmm.
go up into freshwater to spawn,
right.
And then they spend most of their time out in the ocean to feed and grow.
Right.
Eels are the opposite. They
okay.
they spawn in the ocean out in the Sargasso Sea off of Puerto Rico in that area. So well, it's a huge area.
Unbelievable.
We know it's exactly where it is,
yeah,
where they're spawning. But
amazing, amazing.
Yeah, so then they have these little, what they call leptocephali larvae. They look like little, they look like clear leaves.
Hmm.
And they basically float along in the currents, and then they come up into the rivers. They turn into sort of long, pencil-long thing we call elvers. And those are fished commercially for aquaculture.
Okay.
They're sent over to Asia for grow-out to aquaculture. And then the elvers go up into the stream, and some of those are recruited into the population. That is, they start growing into larger
mm-hmm.
Eels. And then when they grow big enough, and it could take them a long time, we've aged some eels down from Oakland Lake down by Mahone Bay, and those eels come out to somewhere between 12 and 20 years old.
Okay.
So they can be in the system for a long time until they get big enough to basically reproduce. So the females will get fairly large. The males don't get all that large, 30, mm-hmm. 40 centimeters, it seems. And that's very system specific as well. But males are generally smaller than females, and then the females will go back out into the ocean to spawn, and they do that usually in September.
Okay.
We get the sort of cooler weather. We get the moon. They're very keyed into the moon cycles,
uh-huh.
and also when there's a good rainstorm. So you know, September rainstorm on a full moon or a new moon, and the eels will be taken off down to out the river to spawn. So the populations have been up and down in a lot of river systems. They're an endangered Kosiwik assessed endangered species.
Are these these are American eels?
Yep, American eels.
Yeah, yep. Right.
And they're very similar to European eels on mm-hmm. the other side of the Atlantic, but they are genetically
mm-hmm.
distinct.
Mm-hmm.
So the populations are up and down. They're at risk. Actually, I'm not sure if they're exactly endangered or not.
Right.
Whether it's just special concern, it fluctuates
mm-hmm.
because
yes.
they're assessed dependent upon population size and how many rivers you find them in, that sort of thing.
Right.
It's a little difficult doing an assessment on eels from a conservation perspective because they're essentially one population. They all intermix down in. Down in the Sargasso, and all their genes get mixed up.
Oh.
So you can't tell one sort of group from another, although there are some recent studies that are showing that there are different what we call ecotypes. And so some eels will spend all of their time in marine waters or saline waters. Some will spend all their time in estuarine waters. Some will spend all their time in freshwater up till the time that they spawn. So we're learning a little bit more about eels now,
mm-hmm.
But basically the populations are pretty low to what they historically were.
Okay.
But we're seeing some recovery in some areas. Last year in the Petacodiac River, they do some monitoring there, and they caught in their traps, over 3,000 eels in there, which sparked us to sort of think, well, are they, again, nice question, are they the same eels we're catching many times, or is it a lot of eels?
Right.
And so we've embarked on doing a little bit of a tagging study this year, so they're up there with the Fort Folly Habitat Recovery is doing that work, and with the Petacodiac Watershed Alliance, and it's a really great start to a little study to look at whether we can use their monitoring station in order to look at the eel populations in that system.
Interesting. An eel is probably a little difficult to tag.
Well, we use what's called a pit tag. So it's
right.
actually an internal tag instead of an external one. Yeah, the external ones don't stay on very long because eels like to live in little crevices and things, and they just Yeah, so if you put a little Floy tag, they call them a dart tag or a spaghetti tag on them, which we use for striped bass and skates, they just wear those off and they don't seem to stay on. Mm-hmm. We put a little internal tag in, which is the same, it's a little glass encased tag, and it's the same technology as you have in clothing stores where they have those little tags where you walk through the door and things go off. Yeah, the same technology. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I know. I've some of the best striped bass fishing I had in the 90s was with live eels. I only got to do that once or twice, but it was just phenomenal. Because I mean, eels are one of the favorite food of choice for striped bass, at least as far as I've heard and I've witnessed. But so it's interesting to hear about the eel studies and all that going on, and maybe that'll correspond with the striped bass populations and where they go, because I don't know, has there been any research done on striped bass populations around the eel populations and how that interacts, or maybe not yet?
No, I think it's a great question, and I know there are lots of anecdotal stories of people getting small eels and that, and using them for bait for striped bass. I'm not sure what the regulations are on that technically.
Yeah, I don't know what it is nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, there's most of the time people are catching Gaspero or herring or something like that that's coming up the system and using that as bait, or buying bait for striped bass for sure. Mm-hmm. That's a huge, pretty good little industry there.
Yeah.
But as far as interconnecting species together on that sort of large ecosystem scale, it's a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I would imagine.
There's a lot of what we call correlation type information that you might get from that. Mm-hmm. So one population's going up, another one's going down.
Right.
You assume it's that population causing the increased population causing the decrease in the other one. But it's really difficult to attach a causation to that and say, well, it's actually that species that's causing the other one to decrease. It could be a lot of trickle-down or cascading effects going on. A top-level predator becomes very prominent and high abundances, large population levels.
Right.
And that might affect all kinds of species. And
sure.
So the other species are sort of scrambling to find their space again.
Mm-hmm.
And you get these systems that are a little bit out of balance.
Right.
We typically can cause this as well. Humans are really good at, extracting a species out of a system and upsetting that balance, and then other things happen to the system. Just as a parallel, we can look at the cod fishery in Newfoundland.
Sure.
It was hammered down pretty low, and it's not rebounding. And one of the theories or ideas that are out there about why that's happening is there's other species that have basically occupied that.
Sure, they filled
one
the void.
The niches. Yeah, they filled the void, and then now the small cod, they basically can't get to that next stage where they're dominant again, because something else is occupying that space, and that could be feeding on the food that the cod want or anything. Right?
Sure, so, that makes total sense. That makes total sense.
Yeah, so trying to get that connection between eels and striped bass, I don't think that one's probably all that attainable at this.
No, I was just thinking out loud as you were talking about the eels.
Absolutely.
And. And definitely we should mention, anybody listening should definitely check the regulations. They change from year to year. What I was referring to was, like I say, a good 20-plus years ago, and I don't even know what the regulations were then. I guess we saw other people doing it, so we assumed it was okay. But so a couple other species that we can touch on real quick before we go are dogfish and sculpin. I know I've encountered both of those. And are those two species still fairly prevalent?
Yeah, sculpin are another one of these bottom dwellers. They like to occupy that area where the skates are. They'll move around a little bit more. They're can get pretty large, and they really will eat anything that they can get into their mouth. So this is probably why you're catching them if you're out in an area where they happen to be. They tend to occupy a little bit deeper waters, though. So if you're along fishing where we're in the large intertidal zones like we get in the Upper Bay of Fundy, the sculpin might be down a little bit deeper. So you'd really have to be a pretty good caster to get one of those on.
Right.
Or the sculpin's venturing a little bit further out of the their natural area.
Right.
I'm not sure, but I don't think they like the sandy bottoms.
No, they're more rocks
as much as the rocky areas. And you know, if you're in the rocky areas, you'll probably get them. So their populations are pretty stable from anything that sort of, well, anecdotes for one. I mean, you hear a lot of commercial fishers say they catch lots of sculpins.
Mm-hmm.
They're in lobster traps all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And they just turn them around and use them for bait. So,
oh.
Commercially, I think from a bait perspective, that's really their only sort of economic value there.
Okay.
And they can get pretty nasty. They got great big spines on
them. Yeah.
Longhorn sculpin is one of the species out there. And,
right.
And they're probably a little more nasty to handle than the skates are, for sure.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So the dogfish that we have, and I haven't spent a whole lot of time, I haven't bottom fished at all in the Minas Basin, but are dogfish fairly common to encounter?
They're making a comeback.
Okay.
It's, probably 25 years ago, they were a dominant species out in the Minas Basin. They would come in there, it's nice warm waters, and it was a big nursery area for their young. So they would come up in there and have their little ones, and there's lots of production up in this area, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a number of years, and Dr. Mike Dadswell, he's a former professor here at Acadia, he's studied dogfish for many years with a guy, Dr. Roger Rolofson, down in North Carolina.
Okay.
And I think Roger has 45,000 of them tagged or something down in North Carolina and up here. So he knows a lot more about how they move around on the eastern seaboard.
Yeah.
But we get a lot of them up in this area. And but they sort of disappeared for 10, 15 years, and there weren't that many of them out there. But in the last 3-4 years, they're making a bit of a comeback, and people are catching them a little more frequently out there fishing.
And
now,
I
don't know what the situation is there, but the balance in the system has changed at some point because they went away, and now they're coming back. So is it a direct assault on dogfish? That's sort of unlikely. It's usually a system-level change that's going to cause a mass exodus of something. And then, you know, why are they back now would be the good question.
And they are actually a species of shark, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
It's funny how they get this name dogfish. I mean, it sounds like such an insulting name for any kind of fish. You know, I've often wondered why, you know, they're not actually called, you know, some kind of shark.
Yeah, they're called the spiny dogfish shark, so they have quite a long name, and I think it's just easier to call them a dogfish.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But they do have, again, they've got some nasty spines on them, so they're a little difficult to handle. The best way to handle them is sort of to pin them down behind their eyes, with your hand, and then you can usually get a hook out pretty easily. And if the body's still sort of flipping around a little bit, then it's not so bad. Sharks in general, if you put some pressure on them, and they'll stop thrashing around.
Yeah,
and that goes right up to the ones that are, you know, 12 feet long.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I did have the opportunity once to get out on the Bay of Fundy and with Art Gaytan of Blue Shark Charters. Actually, we'll talk about this in another episode, but we were out there and we did manage to find a very large porbeagle shark the day that we were out. It was incredible. I don't think there's much of a sport fishery for those right now or not, but there seems to be quite a number of them out there.
That's the blue shark or
no the poor beagles
the poor beagle poor, poor beagle, beagle.
Yeah.
Well, they're recently a protected species,
yeah.
So it's not something that you can really
right.
go after anyway. And they are in they're in pretty short supply despite
okay.
the Canadian stance on it for the last number of years.
Okay,
their populations are pretty low. They're constantly at the ICAT meetings, which is the convention that meets every year to look at setting tuna quotas, but
okay.
they also deal with large scale pelagic fishes, as we call them, ones that are out in that greater water column,
mm-hmm.
and poor beagle sharks is one of them, and that populations are really low worldwide. So it is one of the shark species that we see a lot.
Yeah.
But it's also one that is, and maybe because we see a lot, we know more about it, and we know that it's they're also not in very good shape, those populations.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fascinating. So I guess the bottom line is, you know, all these species, especially these what we would call nuisance species, the skates, the sculpin, the dogfish, they all have their place, and, you know, if you are out angling for striped bass, or I guess that's really the main thing people are going to be angling for, at least in the Bay of Fundy region, unless, you know, mackerel. But if you're mackerel fishing, you're not bottom fishing, so you're not really going to encounter these things. Is to just, you know, try and be nice to them and put them back in, because they do have their place.
Yeah, it's an ecosystem that's why we call it an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
It's an entire system, and when that system to be healthy needs to have many different species in there, and they're all doing different jobs. They're all helping each other out, in essence.
Right.
If one of them starts to dominate or another one goes in decline, then that's when we end up seeing issues. And we don't really know, the systems are so complex in a lot of cases that there's not one-to-one interactions, and it's very difficult to say, well, that species is causing this to happen.
Right.
It's generally an integrated system, and we have to basically tease that apart.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom line is, if you want to keep a good, healthy system for all the species that are out there, and especially the ones that you're trying to target fishing,
mm-hmm.
Then it's to basically look at the whole system and say, no, I'm gonna do my part and keep
right.
the whole system nice,
right.
And that way you're going to keep it all healthy.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, and I suppose where you talked about the green crabs, I know that's a big problem. That's been, I'm assuming it's getting worse all the time.
We had a very cold winter,
right.
And harsh winter last year, and
mm-hmm.
that seems to have knocked them back pretty good.
Okay, good.
So they're not a cold tolerant species. There
yeah.
there is a variant that's a cold tolerant variant, which is now invading Newfoundland. And because Newfoundland is generally much cooler than
right.
it is here,
right.
And the water is much cooler, the Labrador Current up there. So the waters there are a bit cooler, and just some new information that's coming out now is there's a variety that's out.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's a little more cold tolerant. So we might see that one coming down, working its way down here. I don't know. But again, those populations are up and down. There's some projects like Kejimkujik Adjunct there, where they're using
right.
exclusion traps to try and get rid of them, and you know, there's a lot of effort to get rid of them to keep eelgrass beds, which again are eelgrass
right.
beds are good for juvenile fishes, and that's going to keep other populations going.
Yeah.
But they're also a food source for other things.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
We found them in skates. Yeah. We found them in, you know,
right.
striped bass. Things eat green crabs. So
yeah.
They might not be as much of a pest in some situations,
right.
But they certainly are for eelgrass and probably doing a lot of damage to things like worms and clam.
Yeah,
and
I would
like
think.
So,
I would think.
Yeah.
So I guess something to, you know, when you do happen to catch a skate or a sculpin or anything like that, you know, get them back in the water, because they might help keep things like this invasive green crab population down. If that's how you have to think about it, and that simple of a of a...
Yeah, it's almost picking your poison, you know, which one do you hate more?
Exactly, so, yeah.
I'd say the green crab's probably the bigger problem in upsetting the system. All the other species have been there for, you know, thousands of years, and the green crab is the new one.
The new one, yeah. No. Well, I appreciate you taking some time to talk to us today, Trevor, and for anybody listening, I'm going to do up some show notes on this episode, which can be found at maritimeoutdoorsman.com/020 for episode 20. So thanks, Trevor, for chatting, and I'd love to get you back on the show sometime. Maybe we can talk about something else new that's taken place, some new data. Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
Perfect. Thanks, Trevor. Have a great day. So thanks for tuning in to episode 22 of the Maritime Outdoorsman podcast, and a special thanks to Trevor Avery for being my guest on today's show. You can check the show notes at maritimeoutdoorsman.com/022. And if you enjoy the show, I'd like to ask you just a couple things that only take a minute. One, if you are listening on iTunes, if you could take a minute and just give the show a good rating. Two, if you don't already receive our email newsletter, just go to maritimeoutdoorsman.com, and on the right-hand side, there'll be a little subscribe box. And all that is we'll let you know of upcoming episodes and a few other little tidbits once in a while, but we can keep in touch that way. And number three, if you're on Facebook, we'd love to have you as a fan of the show. Just go to Maritime Outdoorsman on Facebook, click like, become a fan of the show, and if you are so kind as to share our updates with your Facebook friends, that would be awesome. So thanks for that. Hey, and before we go, again, I just want to reach out and thank today's sponsor, Flowers River Lodge, Hawk River Outfitters, and Crooks Lake Lodge. Three incredible fly fishing adventures in Labrador. And if you want to find out more, and I would encourage you to do so, just go to maritimeoutdoorsman.com/Labrador. And that does it. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to having you on the next episode.